Stand by. Your Steve Jones Show audio is loading now. SteveJonesShow.com podcasts are sponsored by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury, the beverage supermarket.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Good Friday afternoon, everyone. Great to have you with us here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Headed into the weekend, the Final Four, you must stock up. You have to be ready. You have to sit there when the games start tomorrow at 6. Brewers Outlet. Yes, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. 1-800-795-9565 is our Hilshers General Store hotline. We'll be calling out to Dick Girardi next half hour. In Atlanta on the Hilshers General Store hotline. It's 1-800-795-9565, powered by Hilshers General Store. Go to www.hilshersstore.com, located 7 miles south of Sealands Grove, on routes 11 and 15. And also, we're in the beautiful Sunbury Motor Studio. We'll talk to Dick about the Final Four from Atlanta. Next half hour, we'll break down the Final Four, Wichita State against Louisville, Michigan against Syracuse. We'll talk about that. But also the Ed O'Bannon lawsuit, something that's hanging over college sports right now about whether student-athletes should be paid. We will talk about that and debate it and get your opinion on stadiums being filled up. Should they or should they not get paid? Are they already being paid because of scholarships? We'll talk about that and much more today. But first, above the noise, here's Dan Patrick.
The best get-togethers start with a trip to the beverage supermarket, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury. Why? Because Brewers Outlet has not only a great selection of beer, including imports and microbrews, but also a lot more. Brewers Outlet has water, soda, they roast their peanuts every day, and you can't forget about stopping by the pickle bar. Look for great deals on wine coolers and all your favorite snacks. Before you enjoy those special times with family and friends, make your visit first to the beverage supermarket, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury.
Welcome once again to the Steve Jones Show. Steve joining us again from the Sunbury Motors Studio here in just a few short minutes. As Steve said earlier, busy weekend. It is the Final Four. Dick Girardi checking in from Atlanta. Tell us a little bit about what he thinks we'll see in the Final Four. Rutgers has now officially said it's not a firing, but it's a resigning of their athletic director. Like there's going to be a difference when there's this much scandal around it, but the Rutgers AD says he quit because he wanted to fire immediately. And, I was just saying now that the information is that Pernetti has resigned, which really is one of those things that they said, listen, either resign or we say that you're fired. You pick how we word this news conference.
Well, it's however you can get your settlement. Okay, that's what it comes down to.
Well, but I'm saying is that Rutgers told him it's going to be one or the other. You decide which way is best.
Well, I'll tell you right now, this whole thing is bordering on bizarre because now they're talking about lawyers, HR, and other influences here. What the heck's going on here?
Is there more to this than we're seeing? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, no, but that's what the university president was talking about, lawyers, HR, advice, things like that. Well, if the lawyers are advising you, you can't fire him, then what are you supposed to do?
I just wonder if it's one of those cover-your-butt situations for the university president at this point.
Well, I want to bring up, though, another important question in all this. Right. You have to know the question I'm about to ask is, frankly, one in which I do not expect a reporter to ask because I do not expect most reporters to have a working knowledge of how it works. How about that?
Okay.
All right. The question I would ask is, who is the administrator that conducted the mandated exit interviews of Rutgers basketball players. Because when you graduate, your eligibility's up, you transfer, or your scholarship is not renewed, you have to go through an exit interview, and it has to be with an administrator, not with the coach. So my question would be, who conducted the exit interviews of Rutgers athletes the last 2 years, and what were they told? And if so, and then, if they were told something was happening, what was then told to Tim Pernetti, if anything? For all we know, the players didn't say anything, but I would like to know who conducted the exit interviews, which associate or assistant athletic director under which men's basketball would be in their umbrella, who conducted the exit interviews, what was told to them about 2010, 2011, and 2011-2012.
I do have one question, though.
I'm saying, though, nobody's going to ask that question because I'll bet you didn't even know they had exit interviews.
No, not until yesterday when you mentioned it. No, I didn't realize that. And I didn't realize the exit interview was not done by the coaching staff either.
It is not. It is done by an administrator. It's mandated by the NCAA. Yeah. Now, whether every university does it or not, I have no idea. But it's supposed to be done. Well, if you transfer, go to the pros early, graduate, eligibility up, don't have scholarship renewed, you have an exit interview.
Well, one of the things that came out today in the news conference was that the president had not seen the video until this week. That was the first time you saw the video. Do you find that, in your experience, unusual? Or is that typical of, you know, things that the university president normally wouldn't deal with?
Well, I got 5,000 things to deal with at university.
Everything exactly.
From student affairs to,
sure,
to faculty to donors to...
Which is exactly my point. Is it something he normally wouldn't have dealt with anyway?
Well, first of all, if he knew a video existed, I would demand to see the video.
And if he didn't know a video existed, does that go back to the AD for not informing him? Or should the AD have informed him? See, these are the interesting questions I think about.
Yeah, but for example, you'd have to tell him. Well, how do you know about this? Well, there's a video that was given to us. Okay, that's how you know.
He did say, though, that he regretted, and the way I understand it, he did know there was a video. He just didn't see it. He said that he regretted that he did not ask to see the video when he was first told of the existence.
Well, then fine. Then that's his fault. I would want to know, when I'm dealing with someone's livelihood, okay, they are discussing suspending him. Okay, they're discussing the possibility of firing him or suspending him without pay. And you don't want to look at the video, so it helps you make the decision? You're informed that there is a video. Your options on the table are fire him or suspend him without pay, $24,905, plus fine him $50,000. Okay, now we're up to almost $75,000. And you don't want to look at the video? Are you kidding?
I don't have a response to that. I understand what you're saying. I don't know. I don't get that either. That's what I thought was strange when he said he didn't see the video, and then I found out later on that he did know that it existed, though.
Look, this is an Argo. It's not 2 hours and 8 minutes. Okay? All you got to do is look at 5 minutes of it, and you go, oh, geez. You could tell in 5 minutes. It's different days, different practices, different modes. Some day he has a hat on. Some days a different shirt. Some days they're the left end of the court. Some days the right end of the court. Some days the stands are pulled out. Some days the stands are pulled back. You could tell they're all different days. It takes you 5 minutes to look at it. 5 minutes. I didn't look at it back then? Really? Now, I'd like to know what the HR people told him and what the lawyers told them. Why did the lawyers tell them they couldn't fire him? That supposedly is part of the explanation. Why? And did Tim Pernetti follow university policy under HR? Well, if he did, he shouldn't be fired either. Why do you have policies in place? You follow the policy and, you know, look, let's face it. At a university, the way it is that you follow policies, right? If you overstep your bounds, they get you. That's the way universities are today.
Let me read you his quote. Following review of the independent investigative report, the consensus was that the university policy would not justify dismissal.
Then, if that's the case, then why is Tim Pernetti out of a job? I'm not here to protect Tim Pernetti. That's not my job here. But let's be logical about it. If they're telling you you can't fire him, then you can't fire him.
Oh, wait a minute, though. Pernetti resigned.
No, I'm not talking about Pernetti. I'm saying about firing Mike Rice.
Oh, all right. I was going to say because Pernetti resigned.
He was told he was either going to get fired or resign, so he resigned.
I get that.
Okay? Why is Tim Pernetti out of a job today, if that's the case? That is the second I saw that answer, I looked up and said, wait a minute. Because I don't know Tim Pernetti at all. So I have no dog in the hunt. What do I care?
Yeah, Pernetti in his resignation letter
mentioned
the fact that, yes, he thought he should fire him immediately, and then Rutgers decided to follow a process involving university lawyers, human resources professionals, and the outside counsel, and then found out that the consensus was the university policy would not justify dismissal.
Then why don't you come out and say that on the first day and say, look, this is why I had to do it. I wanted to fire him, but we couldn't.
Right. You beat me to that. Why didn't you say that on day one when this came out instead of saying, well, I thought I could rehabilitate him?
Well, it caught everybody off guard. All right. And that's why I heard Colin Cowherd today going on about the reporter that's breaking the Auburn thing. And he credited her with breaking the Duke lacrosse story. Excuse me. The Duke lacrosse story was all wrong. Go back to your hole in Bristol.
This just got... It went from really, really strange to completely weird, this whole story. I really... Part of me wants to know how they came to the consensus that it was not a fireable offense. That's what I would like to know.
It depends on the policy. For all we know, when they're talking about Pernetti referenced something the other day. Okay, remember this?
Okay, I'm listening.
He referenced it as a first offense.
Yes, I recall that.
And I wonder if that's part of the policy.
Well, and if you remember, that's one of the things we had talked about in his decision to do the rehabilitation. Felt that it was something he could fix. I don't think he used that word exactly.
Yeah, but you know what I think he was doing? I think he was trying to be the leader the other day and say, hey, look, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? And just kind of like, okay, it comes to me. I'm the leader, da-da-da-da-da-da, you know.
Instead of passing it off.
Instead of passing the buck off on everybody else.
Yeah, that's a good observation.
Okay, which we watched yesterday in Atlanta by somebody. Passed it off to everybody else.
That's a very good observation on that. Yeah, I never thought
so
about
he
that
gets
way.
Up there trying to be the big boy about this whole thing, and he gets burned. Well, everybody else is bunkered down. You have university policies, okay? And that's something that has not been discussed enough here at what happened at Penn State about people following the policies and that you're not supposed to stray from them. Dick Girardi from Atlanta on the Final Four coming up in a few moments here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury. I'm ready to stock up at the beverage supermarket. What about you?
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Today's show brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. Final Four coming up tomorrow. We go down south to the great one himself, Dick Girardi, my broadcast partner. Yo, dog.
Great one himself.
Hey, you want the big intro. You want, you know.
Yeah, no, I definitely want the big intro.
I mean, the idea is by doing that, it then I think could potentially lead to bigger paper.
We can only hope.
Dick, you saw Wichita State in person last week when you covered LaSalle at Staples. What struck you about them that watching them on TV does not do them justice?
Yeah, two of everything, Steve. Really deep, interchangeable parts. So not easy to get a great handle on when you're doing like a scouting report because nobody plays even 30 minutes. So you're saying, who do you stop? I think the fact that they basically started over, they lost like 78% of their scoring is a tribute, obviously, to the coach. They run some great stuff. They're not a particularly good three-point shooting team, but they make the ones they have to. And I guess the thing that jumps out more than anything is the rebounding. I mean, they're plus eight a game, and but they played a good league and they played a good non-conference schedule. That's pretty impressive to do over a 38-game schedule in their case.
As you and I watch Wichita, Ohio State the other day, you made a great observation. They used Kraft's aggressiveness against him.
Yeah, they really did. They Aaron is such a tough defender, but they put him in spots. I think they got him uncomfortable and were backdooring him and just coming with blind screens that he wasn't anticipating. And he was trying so hard to make a big play that they used what he's done so well. They used it against him. And they really targeted him. It was interesting. And I think maybe Aaron's a little tired. He's played so many minutes, and you play through the Big Ten that you and I saw all year long. That's just brutal. And he didn't look like he had quite the same jump in his legs that he had early in the year, and I think they noticed it on film, and they used it against him on Saturday.
Look, losing when you're in the tournament, losing in the conference tournament is not a bad thing.
It's not. Yeah, right. And Ohio State, to win it, you know how much energy and effort they had to use. And really, they didn't look good in any of their tournament games. They were very fortunate to beat Iowa State, needed a last-second shot again to beat Arizona. And I give them a lot of credit because I thought they were dead with 10 to go. They actually got back in the game, although I think a lot of it was Wichita just seizing up a little bit. I think that they were just all in from the Big Ten. And as we know, that's perfectly understandable given what the gauntlet was like this year.
No question about that. And the next part, let's get to Rick Pitino. We watch Syracuse. He makes the adjustment in the second half as to how to attack the zone. They were on the verge, as you pointed out to me, of blowing them out in the first half when Ware got hurt. Then they made the adjustment in the second half when it was a two-point game. Is there a better coach of in-game, I see it, I sense it, let's make the change than him?
I don't think so, Steve. Obviously, they have great personnel. They play the style Rick wants. This is the best team he's coached since the 96 Kentucky team, which was one of the best teams I've ever seen in college basketball. And he's got them peaking at the right moment. And you're right. I mean, he knew what Duke's vulnerabilities were. And in the second half, he just made sure the way they were setting those ball screens, that his guys they weren't going to have to go side to side. They were going to be able to make a run right at the rim and to see if somebody could stop them. And obviously nobody could stop Smith or Steva. And I thought that was a great in-game adjustment. And I thought also, beginning of the second half, I thought maybe they were, and Clark Kellogg made the point too on TV, they were maybe putting a little too much pressure on Duke, which gave Curry some open looks. Once they sank their defense back a little bit, they said that he's really the only guy that could beat him. And once they had Seth under control, Duke really didn't have a plan B.
Well, this is something you and I saw in Philadelphia, and we made the observation right away. Plumlee and Kelly, fine players, especially on the collegiate level, but they don't have the foot speed.
And boy, did that show up on Sunday, because they were the last line of defense once the guards got screened, and they couldn't catch these guys. Not that many people can catch Seaver or Smith, because they're as fast as any guards you'll see. But yeah, they just were hopeless. I mean, they are guys that could have gotten back. In fact, Louisville has one of them, Deng, who's got phenomenal athletic ability. Two big guys just don't have that.
And you look at, you know, everyone talked, the Ware injury obviously was a gruesome injury and a tough one to overcome. But at the same time, he'll play next year. I mean, you know, as you know, I broadcast the Adam Taliaferro injury, and you know, sure, we knew he wasn't going to come back. So there's different levels that people have to understand what. But they overcame that. The versatility of his team, what kind of versatility, for example, does Hancock give them? Because we know Rick was the first, really, that said, hey, look, the three-point thing's great, and that's how he got Providence there.
Yeah, Hancock's fascinating, because when he was at George Mason, he really wasn't a shooter. Rick has made him into a shooter, and he's also made him into a defender. I mean, he was the guy that was guarding Curry most of the second half, and who guarded a mannequin when he got to Louisville. And they've made him into a defender, because if you don't defend, you don't play. Now, losing Ware is big, because he really played well, and he was really good against Syracuse. Title game. Having said that, I still think Louisville has the best players, but I would think, obviously, if he was playing, Steve, they could do even more things. Rick's just going to have to change some of the things he wants to do a little bit, but he'll do it, because, you know, that's why he is. Hopefully, going into to be announced into the Hall of Fame on Monday, I'm like stunned he wasn't in 5 years ago and somehow didn't make it last year after he was a finalist. If he doesn't make it this year, there needs to be an investigation.
Yeah, you know what? I think the leaving of Kentucky for the NBA and then back again, like, you know how emotional people get about these things.
I know, I understand. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what happened, because he didn't have all that great success with the Celtics. But, I mean, if you think about him going back, as you said, even to his Boston University days and then at Providence, where he took a team that had no business being in the Final Four, because he was the first coach to understand the value of the three-point shot back in 87. He's always been way ahead of the curve, and he still is. And I give him a lot of credit, because a lot of coaches, they coach a certain way. They stick with it. It works for them. But the great coaches are the guys that can adapt and change with the times, and that's what Rick has been able to do.
Right. In fact, the first time I ever saw him coach a game was against Penn State when he was at BU. It was his last season at BU, and it was in Rec Hall. Now let's get to Syracuse. Memo to Tom Crean, there is a way to play a 2-3 zone, right?
There is. I think the issue is, Steve, you need to have they had one of the requisites. They had three-point shooting, but obviously Syracuse decided, look, we're not letting you get them off, so we're going to just guard the line with our length. So if they're going to guard the line, you have somebody who can catch the ball at the foul line and make an intelligent play with it, either a jump shot or a pass, or like Louisville did when they ran the double high in the Big East Final.
Right.
They had an answer for it, and Temple had an answer for it when they played him, because they got the ball into the middle. Now, I don't know that Michigan has that person. I think they have McGarry down on the box that can finish, and certainly Robinson can dunk. I don't know who that person is who catches the ball in the middle of the zone and makes a play. So it may end up having to be Burke just dribbling into the middle of it and doing something. I haven't noticed a guy for them that I would feel confident as a catcher and thrower from the middle of that zone.
Right.
At least not that we've seen so far out of Michigan, and we've obviously seen them a lot.
Yeah, we've seen them a lot, and they don't. But they do have something that Indiana doesn't have, and that is length. And Syracuse has great length in that 2-3 zone, but Michigan also counters with some length as well. The question is whether they can shoot over the darn thing.
Yeah, Jeff Neubauer, who's the coach at Eastern Kentucky and was a John Bielamp top assistant at Richmond and then West Virginia, I talked to him today, Steve. He said the thing that they've noticed, they actually played them when they were at Richmond. They played Syracuse in the zone to try to get to the NIT Final Four. And he said they got the ball when they wanted it the whole game, but they didn't have dunkers. He said the last line better dunk the ball, because if you go up soft, somebody's going to be there to block it.
Right.
And you have to get shots around the rim. You just rely on they'll guard. So if Michigan can get the ball into the middle, get a few down low and with the dunks from Robinson or McGarry, then all of a sudden Stauskas and Burke and Hardaway are going to be open, because you got to guard something. So I think that's the key. You got to get the ball down low first. I think that's the key to beating that zone. Now, the Burke is going to be interesting, because I think he may try to dribble to beat it. And it may work. We'll see. But obviously they haven't played anything like that zone.
in the Big Ten because nobody plays it like Syracuse.
But John Beilein saw it a lot at West Virginia. He didn't have a lot of success against it, but he saw it when he was at West Virginia, so he's been around the block with it.
He has. I mean, he's 0 for life against Syracuse, including Canisius Richmond at West Virginia, but at no time did he have the better players. Now his players are comparable. You kind of wish they were not between a sophomore and a junior. Yeah. Right, which is what they're going to start. You'd rather have somebody with a little more experience that's played against it. And the other problem is they're playing it so well, Steve. I mean, they played it good all year. This is the numbers they're putting up in this tournament are ridiculous. I mean, teams are shooting 28% again in four games and 15 from the three. If that happens on Saturday, they're going to win. But I do think Michigan has the requisite skill set. It's just a question that they have that one player who can catch the ball and make some decisions in the center of the game.
And here's the other part that I don't think anybody ever talks about. In that 2-3 zone, which they have a lot of length up front between Carter Williams and Trish. I mean, people don't realize. You're talking about 6'5", 6'6", guards up front.
Yep.
They're already in a leak-out position on a break. And a lot of people don't realize that in the Syracuse 2-3 zone, that those two guards are already in a leak-out spot.
Yes, Steve, I know that because back in the day, and this is like way back in the day, when I could still actually run, I used to love to finish on the left side. So I always played the left side of the zone. And what people don't realize is that's the first go to a fast break. You're already in your lane, right? And the ball comes to the middle, and you got two guys running the wings. And that's why Syracuse, their offense is so great when they're in transition, when they just made a steal or a rebound off a bad miss. Because there's a lot of bad shots against that. And bad shots that every coach will tell you is the first pass to the fast break. And that's where their offense in the half court is average best.
Right.
But when they start getting steals and turnovers, which they've got the ton of in this tournament, then they can put up enough to score.
Yeah, which has been amazing because what happened was that Georgetown bogged them down into a half court game. They scored 39. They've made adjustments out of that since, and they've done a much better job of being a running team starting with the Big East tournament.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing. Since that 39, last game of the regular season, they've won every minute of every game except the last 10 minutes of the Big East tournament when they got swamped by Louisville. I mean, they've dominated games. They were dominating Louisville in that game. They were up 17. So, yeah, they've been great. And a lot of us, including me, left them for dead. But they're ready. And I give them the slight edge just because of their experience, the unusual part of the defense, but I have so much respect for John Beilein, and Michigan's guys have just a phenomenal amount of skill. And fortunately for them, they're not going up against a great half-court offensive team because Michigan is not a great half-court defensive team.
No.
That's just a fascinating game. I'm still trying to see that game. You know, sometimes you can see what a game might look like beforehand. I just can't yet visualize what those players look like against each other on the court. I may not be able to do it till Saturday night.
The setup starting in 2009 where they put the court in the middle of the dome and then built everything around it. Offensively, has that changed anything in what you've watched over the years in dome basketball?
Yeah, I think threes are harder to make because of the background, and I think that's one of the many reasons why Louisville has changed their offense so dramatically here in the tournament, where they're just trying to drive everything. Because the background's irrelevant if you're dunking.
Right.
Or finishing at the rim. Background is not coming to play. So I think that the teams that are – and Michigan's shooting a high percentage also from three. And they just played the dome. They played the Jerry Jones dome. So they were able to do it. But I do think, Steve, that's generally a problem. I think it's going to be a huge problem for Wichita because they haven't played in the dome yet, ever. They played in the Staples Center, and before that they were playing in Salt Lake City. So – the other teams, Syracuse obviously plays in a dome. Michigan and Louisville just played in domes in the regionals. So that's going to be a real problem for Wichita on Saturday, trying to adjust to the shooting background.
What do you make, Dick, of the Ed Rush situation in the Pac-12?
Yeah, it's bizarre because I know they're saying Ed Rush said the comment in jest, but then Sean Miller gets this bizarre technical for saying essentially next to nothing,
which was his first of the season, I believe.
Right, he's not generally a screamer. It suggests to me that he had been complaining to the league officer, to some of the referees, and
And they said, oh, well, that's it. You know, give him a tease. You'll get 5,000. Do I think it was a serious thing that Rush said? I doubt it. They're saying it wasn't serious, but the fact that he got this quick tee for no reason gives at least a rise to suspicion. I know Larry's kind of saying everything is good. He's not going to change anything. It just doesn't look right. I don't know that the guy necessarily needs to get fired, but something just appears amiss there.
And it's odd, too, because Larry Scott has at least given one the impression in 2 years on the job that he's done virtually everything right so far in terms of how he has judged things.
Yeah, so I maybe without knowing the facts, and you and I can relate to this better than most, without hearing Ed Rush's side of the story and Sean Miller's, I'm not going to make a real judgment on it, but it just seems strange that the technical happened in that way after he had made that comment. That's just the part that is a little unusual.
Yeah, there's a difference between suspicion and there's a difference between fact. So
yeah, and I've been like this forever because we're in the business, and it's easy to jump to conclusions on part of stories, and I just try to wait and find out all of it. And the problem is a lot of times you just never really find out all of it, so you have to try to come up with the best version of the truth. And in this case, I don't know any of the people, and
right.
I'm sure Scott has talked to Rush and Sean Miller, and maybe he's come up with the right answer. Without knowing what they said, I don't know what the right answer is.
My man, safe trip down to Atlanta. We will talk obviously frequently during the week. Appreciate it.
You got it. Thanks, Steve.
All right, pal. Dick Girardi with us. We'll come back with more on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Ready for a quality pre-owned vehicle? Well, get them before they go to auction at Sunbury Motors. Go to sunburymotors.com and click on pre-auction blowout. With so many great deals in bloom, you'll be thinking spring. Like a 2009 Ford Econoline cargo van E150 and a 2004 Volvo XC40 four-door twin turbo with four-wheel drive, both with the lowest price promise, so you gotta call 888-536-8017. 2012 Hyundai Elantra four-door sedan GLS reduced to $15,943. 2011 Subaru Legacy four-door sedan, just $21,498. And a 2010 Chevy Equinox four-wheel drive LTZ, $24,998. All come with a Carfax report and our lowest price promise. Pre-auction blowout. 24/7 at sunburymotors.com, at the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at our dealership, Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sunbury Motors, a tradition of trust since 1915.
All right. This has not been exactly a week for collegiate sports to crown itself in glory. Between the Ed Rush situation, and the more I read about that, you know, he's saying 100% said in jest and so forth. But you know what? There are other officials that are in the room at the time, and they didn't feel like it was in jest. And there were several officials in the Pac-12 that said, look, he had to go because, look, he said our integrity was being called into question, and their possibility of assignments was being called into question. And on top of that, the possibility that they were going to lose some officials who are independent contractors, by the way, also comes into play. They're independent contractors. Well, if they find out that there was that rush in the Pac-12, they might not get other jobs other places. So they were, you know, internally, those officials were saying, look, they had to get rid of them. So that's one. The Auburn thing, who knows? Okay, Auburn has always been a university that's been to the edge many times. You know, despite winning the national championship in 2010, they are still the poor sister in the state. They do not have exactly what you call the Chamber of Commerce campus in the world. And Bear Bryant always referred to them as, quote, that cow college.
Yeah, I always liked the cow college.
That's okay, yeah. Yes, it is nasty. All right. So that's always been an issue. Now, did any of this happen? Who knows? Is it worth looking into? Yeah. Did the writer that wrote it have an impeccable track record? Well, gee, I don't know. There's several Duke lacrosse players that say no. Okay. So Ed Rush, because of the complications, and this was something, by the way, not that when you read more stories about it, he didn't just say it once, he said it another time too. And it's the location it took place in. It wasn't a social event at a restaurant. It was actually when in a meeting. He said he was trying to lighten the mood at the meeting and so forth. But there were officials in that room that thought he was dead serious. Because they were saying earlier he was taking a chair and he's pounding the chair up and down because he was unhappy about what three officials had done in a previous game and how he felt they lost control of that game. All right? So in the end, Larry Scott has, you know, he resigns and Larry Scott has to accept it. I mean, because now officials are being called into question. Integrity is being called into question. You can't have that. He may have said he said it in jest and so forth, but there are too many people in the room that didn't feel that way based on subsequent interviews I've seen. How about that? The Rutgers thing is just a flaming mess.
And it gets messier.
I mean, nobody's making it better. Mike Rice had to be fired. That's an absolute. That had to happen. Jimmy Martelli had to go, too. He's on the tape acting like, I mean, I'm sorry, assistant coaches don't act like that. Okay? And they take their lead from the head coach. But the next part is that who conducted the exit interviews the last 2 years in academic years 2010, 2011, 2011, 2012 with the players that either graduated, transferred, left the program, whatever, or ran out of eligibility? Who conducted those exit interviews? And did the subject come up? And if so, was it then relayed to Tim Pernetti? That is an issue. A big issue. You are required to conduct exit interviews by an administrator with the student athlete. And the administrator cannot be a member of the coaching staff. And then the university president today making jokes. It just wasn't his day.